You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of June 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, we'll unpick some of the complexities of the UK's new government and why its formation is proving to be a divisive rather than binding agreement. My guests, Michael Binion and Carol Walker, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including...
I know there's been some anxiety about what would happen to EU citizens at the point we leave the European Union. Today I want to put that anxiety to rest.
But is Theresa May's offer to current EU residents in the UK enough? We'll be asking what kind of future will be faced by millions in the country. Plus, as the White House warns of another chemical weapons attack from Syrian President Assad, is it time that the watching world took action?
There can't be a worse sight, and it shouldn't be allowed. That's a butcher. That's a butcher.
And we'll ask why Donald Trump, who you just heard there, is deemed less trustworthy around the world than his predecessor. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to today's edition of Midori House. My guests today are Michael Binion, foreign affairs specialist for The Times, and the political commentator Carol Walker. Welcome both to the programme. Very good to have you both with us. The realities of yesterday's announcement from the UK's Conservative government that they will award the not insignificant amount of £1 billion extra to Northern Ireland in exchange for parliamentary support from the region's DUP are starting to set in. Among the realities are questions such as... where did this money magically appear from? And why can't nations within the UK, such as Scotland or Wales, have some of it too? Carol, I'll start with you perhaps first of all. Where do we begin with this? Wales and Scotland probably not happy, but it seems really nobody's happy.
Yeah, absolutely. Wales and Scotland, absolutely furious. Carwin Jones, leader in Wales, said it was a straight bung in Scotland. Nicola Sturgeon described it as a grubby little deal. I think people generally feel £1 billion for communities across Northern Ireland, very nice for them. But if the government can suddenly magically shake this money tree and find this money for them, well, why not find it for other communities? Lots of people have been doing calculations. The Lib Dems are saying you could have an extra teacher in every secondary school in the whole of the UK. There could be a 2% rise for all NHS staff. You could have sprinklers fitted to 6,000 tower blocks. I think an awful lot of residents in those sorts of tower blocks would go for that. But I think the money is just one element of this hugely controversial deal. Let's not forget the Democratic Unionist Party, for example, has opposed any extension of abortion rights in Northern Ireland. You can only, as a woman, get an abortion if your life is in danger. They've opposed gay marriage. Of course, no one is suggesting that this deal is going to give them influence over such matters across the rest of the UK. But a lot of senior Tories are saying, well, is it really a good idea for the Conservatives to be forming such a close liaison with a party like this when we've had years of them trying to modernise the Conservative brand? We had Lord Paton at the weekend saying it would toxify the Conservative brand. And that is before you get to this whole very delicate issue of the politics of Northern Ireland. We've got the Assembly there currently suspended, a crisis about how Northern Ireland is going to be governed. The UK, the Westminster and the Irish governments are committed under the Good Friday Agreement for being even-handed in their dealings in Northern Ireland's political future. And people are rightly asking, how can the British government possibly be even-handed fair broker when it's dependent on the DUP for Theresa May to stay in power?
Michael, I mean, there you have it. The quintessential political hornet's nest into which a stick is being seemingly repeatedly stuck. What do you think poses the most profound immediate problem, particularly for Theresa May? Is it this question about inequality of resource allocation, or is it take your pick from the litany of things that Carol
listed?
Well,
I think it's two things, and it depends. If the negotiations going on to form a new devolved government succeed, then the big problem is the grumps and gripes from Scotland, Wales and others. On the other hand, if the attempt to form a devolved government at Stormont, the seat of government in Belfast, if that falls apart, because of this, and because the Sinn Féin leaders say that Britain is not being even-handed, then I think that will be the immediate crisis. Set against all that, I must say, however, there is one overwhelming advantage to all this, which is the reason she's done it. If it was just a hornet's nest, you would think, what on earth is she causing herself so much trouble for? The overwhelming advantage is that it does, for the moment, give the government a nominal majority in Parliament, which means it can get on with passing laws and get on with the business of government.
But even Sir John Major, former Prime Minister, was saying she didn't actually need to do the deal because the DUP have historically been very close, very supportive of the Conservative Party. The DUP are also very, very concerned that Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, has had a long association with the Republican cause, a long association with a lot of the leaders of Sinn Féin. The last thing they would want to do is anything that would let Jeremy Corbyn end up being Prime Minister, and that Theresa May could probably have counted on the support of the DUP in those crucial votes on things like the Queen's Speech, getting the budget through, even without doing a deal and annoying so many people.
Well, yes, that's possible. But at the same time, if they saw that they were really in that sort of position to tweak the nose of the government, they could easily have threatened a bit of brinkmanship. And now at least they have promised they won't do that. They still could do it, of course, and they still could ask for more money. And I think the general feeling is that this is a deal that is not going to last a very long time because the present setup is so fragile and so precarious, almost certainly the government will need to go to the country again fairly soon to get a better majority, if it can, or at least a situation where one party or the other is in a position to form a government.
And Carol, I wanted to ask you about, I guess it's rather an irony in the situation, given the political sort of stasis, I guess, if you look at Northern Ireland specifically, with their inability to sort of get things moving in terms of their own administration there, the DUP now, well, the guarantors, at least in the short term, of Westminster stability. There's certainly an irony there. But, I mean, do you agree with Michael that actually it won't be something that's put to the test even over the medium term because it's unlikely to last that long?
Well, I think what's important to bear in mind is that this is not a coalition. This is what's called a confidence and supply deal. It just means that all the DUP are going to do is to make sure that the government can survive a confidence motion, so the government's not actually going to fall, and that it will be able to get through the overall vote on the Queen's Speech. Now, the DUP have also said that they will support the government in getting Brexit, but they are not in any way bound to support the government on every single vote. We're going to have a huge welter of legislation tied to the Brexit process. In fact, the entire parliamentary programme for the next 2 years is going to be dominated by it. And there are going to be lots of specific votes on things like agriculture and fisheries and customs and immigration. The DUP isn't committed to supporting the government on every single one of those votes. And you can be damn sure that behind the scenes, they will, I'm sure, be trying to seek perhaps a little bit more out of the government on some of their own pet projects as a price of ensuring they get through those. Theresa May is going to have to battle and struggle and do deals and wrangling behind the scenes day after day, vote by vote, to get her programmes through Parliament.
We'll talk a bit more about EU and Brexit and some of the bigger international issues facing May and the UK in a moment. But just on one sort of Brexit-related point here, Michael, I think we've even talked before about the border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. Does the fact that the DUP are in this sort of power-broking role materially change that? Because obviously they have an interest to a degree in maintaining a Good Friday Agreement, and yet one would imagine that there are many people within the DUP party who'd be, I don't know, perfectly happy with the return of a harder border between the two countries.
Yes, well, that's a bit of a paradox. Certainly some people would see, and still do see, the Republic as still hostile territory, and they don't really want this completely open to-ing and fro-ing. But it's been shown that over the years, when the border has virtually disappeared, the economy of both sides has hugely improved as a result, and no government wants to unilaterally introduce yet a further obstacle to its own prosperity, although, of course, they've just set that off with this very large amount of money. But I think it is a matter of faith for everyone in Northern Ireland now that the island will not be divided so sharply as it was before. And there are going to be, have to be quite a few negotiations with the Republic as to whether they can fulfil some of the tasks that perhaps Britain should do as a country outside the EU. In other words, border controls being checked in the Republic instead of in the north, in order to keep a soft border. There will still be a border of sorts, and I think it will not be as porous as it is now. But the DUP, I think, is committed to try to make sure that that issue at least is handled to their advantage in Brussels.
And Carol, what do you make of that? Because one imagines that if the border stays soft-ish or as soft as possible, does that, I mean, it's hard to think that that doesn't have an inevitable knock-on effect because it's the only land border between the UK and the EU post-Brexit. I mean, it must have a knock-on effect, no, in terms of the freedom of movement of people going forward.
Well, it's interesting that if you talk to, for example, the DUP are in favour of leaving the customs union, but they don't want a hard border. As Michael was saying, nobody wants this hard border because there's a huge amount of trade that goes on there, and people feel that it would be detrimental to the economies both sides if that were to be reimposed. But talking to those who have been closely involved in this sort of issue, they point to a situation whereby, for example, yes, there would be an issue about goods. You would be have to expect a certain amount of checks, perhaps some spot checks at certain points, but an awful lot could be done electronically on goods, which, for example, might be able to get into Ireland tariff-free, but then have to be liable for some sorts of tariffs if they go into Northern Ireland. When you talk about people, the explanation that has been put to me is that there wouldn't necessarily be a problem or a need to check people coming across the border, because it wouldn't be a problem if citizens just crossed the border. The question is what rights they would have if they crossed from an EU country into a non-EU country, and that they could then be checked if they applied for jobs, if they applied for benefits, if they applied for housing, and that that would be the way that it could be administered. But yes, there are all sorts of questions about exactly how this can possibly work, and an awful lot is going to have to depend on the negotiations and what is decided about the status of people, about goods, about trade, none of which has been settled yet.
Well, away from the island of Ireland, Theresa May, as well as alienating large chunks of the UK, seems to have found time to offend much of the European Union too. Her recently unveiled plan for the future of EU residents living in the UK post-Brexit hasn't gone down particularly well. Many of those who already have permanent residence will be asked to reapply to obtain permission to stay, which one imagines means spending more money, filling out more forms and dedicating more time, and at the same time wondering, was I not part of the UK already? Michael, how much is that the question here? Another issue which is very difficult for Theresa May to handle, but they're posing questions which surely for many of these people will have already been posed and answered adequately, or so it seemed, in the recent past.
Yes, it's pretty incomprehensible in a way. I mean, first of all, it looked as though this was a sort of advance, as though she was offering something a bit more generous, and that she was saying to everyone living in the UK, the 3.2 million EU citizens, you're welcome to stay. But then the small print suggested that actually there are a few more hurdles to jump over. And as you say, those who've already got status of permanent resident status, are now going to be asked to do some more form filling and to, presumably they'll be told, yes, it's just formality, you can stay anyway. But then we've got this question about how long have they been there and did they come before the cut-off date? And we don't yet know when the cut-off date is, whether it's when Britain triggered Article 50 in March or whether it is in 2 years' time when we are meant to actually leave the EU. Or it might even be after that if we have a transitional arrangement. So it's completely unclear. And I think the sense of uncertainty is what is upsetting people, and it's still linked to some extent to the status of British citizens in the EU. So to some extent, we're still using these people as a bargaining chip, and the whole point of what the Europeans said is this should be settled not as a bargaining chip, but as a matter of moral principle, and that should be a unilateral declaration, probably by both sides. And that is what most of the people living in this country would like.
It's interesting you mentioned that bargaining point, Fraser Michael. Of course, Jeremy Corbyn himself used that today. He said the government's using people as bargaining chips. Is there a truth to that, Carol? And how does Theresa May convince the public of Britain, and I guess convince Brussels as well and the wider European bloc public, that she's not playing that kind of game?
Well, I think once again, Theresa May appears to have misjudged how her offer was going to go down. She said this was a fair and serious offer. Clearly, it was intended to try to build a bit of goodwill in these negotiations. But I think the way she handled it ensured that simply wasn't what happened. We've already had Michel Barnier, the main EU negotiator, saying we need more ambition, more clarity, more guarantees are all needed. And I think part of the problem is that she sketched a broad outline when she met the EU leaders last week. She then sketched a little bit more in the Commons yesterday. But as Michael's been pointing out, there are still a lot of questions about this. I think, to be fair to her, if she had from the outset said, right, well, we're just going to guarantee these rights and, well, we'll just hope for the best in terms of the million or so UK citizens who are living in other parts of the EU, then there would have been an outcry from some of those citizens and presumably some of the tabloid press saying that she'd hung them out to dry. But what she now seems to have done is entered a sort of halfway house where she's not quite on insisting on a reciprocal arrangement, but she's sort of saying, well, look, I've made this offer and you've got some of the details, and now it's up to you guys to make a similar offer for those British citizens living across the EU, many of whom, of course, are very worried about what the future is going to bring and whether they're going to still be able to get their healthcare, their pensions and so on.
And another thing that strikes me, Michael, is that wherever we look, you mentioned that there's more questions than answers, and then even these partial answers throw out more questions and more potential timelines and this sort of thing. One thing that does seem almost guaranteed wherever you look is more admin, more bureaucracy, more costs, more form filling. Now, some people have said, oh, well, you know, if only we knew about this before, I might have voted differently in the Brexit vote. No one made it clear that there'd be all of these costs and all of this complexity. But people were warned about that, and it was surely inevitable that this was going to happen.
I don't think that would have made a bean of difference, because the people who are going to have to do all the admin and all the costs are not those who voted in the referendum. Those were British citizens. Those EU citizens weren't able to vote in the referendum. So, of course, they would all have voted to remain anyway. And I don't think actually that would have mattered at all. The problem also is magnified by the fact that this administration is going to be carried out by the Home Office. Now, Theresa May was Home Secretary in charge of policy for the interior of Britain. By everybody's account, the Home Office is the most intractable, the most bureaucratic, the most difficult to deal with of any ministry in Britain, and always has been. And therefore, if you're talking about bureaucracy, you can add that, you can do times 10 is what we're likely to expect. And I think that will make it particularly difficult.
What's fascinating about this is supposed to be an issue on which at least the UK and the rest of Europe agrees. Everybody agrees, yep, the rights of those EU citizens should be guaranteed and we should be able to sort out some sort of reciprocal arrangements on benefits and so on. Both sides have agreed that this should be sorted out at the start of the negotiations. But even on this issue, where they agree on the principles, there's a disagreement. There's a disagreement, for example, on who's going to oversee all of this. Theresa May has said, there's no way I'm going to allow the European Court of Justice to have jurisdiction over this in the UK. The rest of the EU are saying, well, of course it must. And by the way, who's going to guarantee those rights of UK citizens right across the EU? So on this issue, on which both sides agree in principle, that should all be guaranteed, nobody should be forced to go home, they simply can't agree on the details, and that doesn't really bode terribly well for the rest of the process.
Well, let's pause on that sobering thought. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, Carol Walker and Michael Binion. Coming up next, is the United States about to wade deeper into the Syrian conflict, and is it high time that it did?
Are you an entrepreneur, architect, city maker, shop owner, media player, property developer or chef? Then you need a ticket to the most important conference on delivering quality of life in our cities. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference is back, and this year is touching down in Berlin. Join us from the 29th of June to the 1st of July for great debate, informative panels, engaging hospitality, and a chance to see the best of Berlin. Let's make better places to live. Join us. Be inspired. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2017. Head to conference.monocle.com to book your ticket.
You're listening to Midori House, 20 minutes past the hour. Still with me are Carol Walker and Michael Binion. Now, the White House yesterday claimed that President Bashar al-Assad may be preparing another chemical weapons attack on his own people in Syria. The US has said that the nation will pay a heavy price were an attack to take place. They're strong words, but is it time the US and its partners took the initiative on the issue? Assad has grim past form in this regard, and the world has done seemingly little to prevent it thus far. Michael Binion, is this empty rhetoric from the US? You know, going back, Barack Obama talked about red lines. There was inaction. He's painted red lines before about, I don't know, North Korea, even with Assad. Is this meaningless? Or do you think that the US has painted itself into a corner where it's going to have to act if it learns of an atrocity such as they're alluding to?
Well, it is rhetoric, but I don't think it's necessarily empty. I think it does mean that the US is quite convinced that hitting at Syria actually will be a deterrent. It certainly appears to have worked last time. There wasn't a further retaliation. The rest of the world applauded when they sent Tomahawks into this airbase, and it did look as though that it stayed Assad's hand for a while. What's a bit mysterious is why the US has suddenly now announced that it is ready to do it again when there's no obvious visibility to the preparations for another chemical attack. I mean, it's quite possible that US intelligence has learned of such a thing and they can monitor from satellites and whatever, movement of weapons and whatever, that could be preparatory to an attack. But it's also quite unusual to announce this in public, sort of saying, guys, they're about to launch another attack and this is what will happen. On the other hand, if that does deter the Syrians from doing that, in a way, no harm done. I mean, it's probably a good thing. I think this is on one area where Trump actually has found that there has been considerable support for what he's done, and that he's quite surprised about this and says, well, if it worked once, let's try it again.
I mean, Carol, would you go along with that reading? Is this an example of, I don't know what you might call it then, the new Trump diplomacy in action? And maybe, as Michael says, even if it wasn't the exact intention, basically working?
I think the problem is that it's very difficult to work out what the US strategy is here. And there were reports, certainly in some of the US newspapers, saying that other arms of government in the Pentagon and so on were rather taken by surprise when the president's press secretary announced overnight that there were going to be very serious consequences and they'd got this intelligence. So I think the question is, it's very difficult to read some of these pronouncements. And Sean Spicer makes these announcements. Donald Trump sends his tweets out overnight. And whether that means that, yes, the Americans are preparing to carry out another strike as they did after the previous, what everyone took to be a chemical weapons attack. I mean, appalling what Assad has done on the ground. Some 80 people killed back in April. And the agencies said that there was evidence that sarin gas or a similar agent had been used. And I think certainly in the UK and elsewhere, if this threat from President Trump does deter Assad from something similar, then they would applaud it. But I think the question is, what is the US going to do? Is it going to carry out another strike? What exactly would it hit at? Is it able to detect where these chemical weapons are being prepared? And is it prepared to go any further? The question always, and Michael knows a lot more about this area than I do, is when you carry out a military strike, the question is what you're going to do next and what the actual overall goal and target is. And I think the problem with the current White House is nobody is quite sure exactly where President Trump is going, given that he came to power, obviously very keen to disengage from some of the conflicts which the US had been involved in the past and simply talking about America first.
And yet, as you suggested before, Michael, in fact, he seems to have had some sort of small gains, some small kind of PR wins in these areas, Trump. Do you think that if, I don't know, maybe there's another strike, even if it's quite surgical, like the one you mentioned before on the airfields previously, would that embolden him still further? He must obviously be wary about Russian air forces are involved as well, and that would be a conflict he wouldn't want to get into. But how far do you think he might take it if he's emboldened yet further?
You're quite right. I think the primary thing is, what would the Russian reaction be? The Russians more or less turned a blind eye last time round, because I think they also didn't like the idea of being associated with a regime that used chemical weapons. It's not good for their image. Although they had to come to the kind of rescue, they put out a whole lot of really misleading information suggesting that actually it was the rebels themselves that had done this, or that somehow that the whole thing was faked and whatever. They were clearly embarrassed by it, and therefore they turned a blind eye. Now, a second strike, I don't think they would turn such a blind eye. There is another issue at play here, and that is that Trump looks more and more determined to find a reason to have a go at Iran. Mm-hmm. Now, Iran is very deeply involved in the Syrian conflict. They've got quite a few men there. They've got people fighting. They've got weapons. And they are on the side of President Assad. And they're ready to put up a considerable resistance. Now, if Trump is looking for an excuse to have a go at Iran, this would be a good area to do so, because he would be seen to be sort of taking on the country that the rest of the Arab world is deeply suspicious of. It's quite unclear. There are so many interwoven and intertangled disputes going on in the Middle East at the moment. There's a whole completely separate thing between Saudi Arabia and its allies having a row with Qatar, which leaves America slightly nonplussed as to what to do about that one. I think the president may put out a few tweets, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. But when it comes to it, I think caution for the moment is likely to be a fairly important watchword.
Well, let's talk a bit more about Trump. A divisive figure, I think, is the understatement of the year, probably. A new study, though, by the Pew Research Center reveals, perhaps unsurprisingly, that not many people around the world trust him. The image of the United States' reputation globally is plunging as a result. The survey polled 37 nations, with some of the US's allies, Canada, Mexico, Spain and Germany, showing the steepest declines, I guess some of them more predictably than others. Carol, you've already talked about maybe a lack of confidence in terms of the political watchers of Trump's grand strategy. We talk about all these proxy disagreements around the world. Does he or anyone in his administration have a sense of the nuance? What about this issue of trustworthiness abroad? Can he do anything to rebuild, to add some luster back to the US's reputation, which has taken a few blows in that regard recently?
Well, I think that when you look at some of the early steps that he's taken as president, it's probably not surprising that, especially in countries like Mexico, they don't particularly
trust...
That was
the obvious one on my list.
The United States. If you fight an election talking about America first and then say you're going to go ahead and build this wall, and then you start banning people from travelling to the United States or trying to do so on flights from various Muslim nations, then of course that has now got knocked down in the courts, and there's legal battles continuing on all of that. But if the message that you send out to the outside world is that you're basically hostile to them and you don't particularly want to do much with them, and you're very worried about their people coming to your country, I think it's hardly surprising that people don't trust them. And I think what's interesting here in the UK is the way that Theresa May was one of the first to go there, to go to the Trump White House. There was, of course, this picture of her holding hands with Donald Trump. Now, we're told afterwards that's because he doesn't like walking down steps, and she was just doing the honourable thing and helping him down there. But that picture of Theresa May holding Donald Trump's hand, that caused horror amongst many people here in the UK. And I think it's very interesting that when we had the Queen's speech, which includes lots of the state visits being listed at the end, there was no mention of that state visit for President Trump, who's supposed to be still coming here at some stage
Indeed.
This year.
We'll
no date yet.
Michael, very, very briefly, just in a word or two, It would be a generational question, wouldn't it, to restore, to re-gild the US reputation?
It would, but there's a very easy way to do it, and that is to take away Donald Trump's Twitter account. those around him are putting out a few reasonably balanced and thought-through policies, the so-called adults in the White House, undermined every single night by these extraordinary, completely undisciplined tweets.
There you go. Take his keys away and all will be better. Michael Vignon and Carol Walker, thank you both very much indeed for being with us on Midori House. Thanks too to the show's producer, Tom Hall, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Fiametta Sitana, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. More music next. We'll have more on all the big stories of the day at 2200 London time. That's on the Monocle Daily. Andrew Muller's in the chair. This programme's back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.